This episode of Boat Briefing is sponsored by Amico & Co. Based in Genoa, at the heart of the Mediterranean, Amico & Co. is a family-owned refit yard with more than two centuries of maritime heritage behind it. Today, the yard is widely recognised for its work on large yachts, offering a full-service refit capability delivered largely through its own in-house teams, from paint and engineering to complex conversions and structural projects. Rooted in one of Europe's great historic port cities, Amico combines tradition, technical depth, and long-term thinking, making it a trusted partner for owners, captains, and shipyards alike.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Big Boat Interview. I'm Lucy Dunn, the Content Director of Boat International, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Olivia Swack-Goleman, Executive Director of the Wildlife Justice Commission. Olivia is a leading voice in the fight against wildlife crime, working at the intersection of international law, diplomacy, and environmental protection. We're especially pleased to welcome her as the keynote speaker at our annual Ocean Talks on the 11th of June this summer. With more than three decades of experience in international criminal and humanitarian law, Olivia has held senior roles at institutions including the International Criminal Court and the Netherlands Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Today, she leads the Wildlife Justice Commission, working closely with law enforcement agencies to tackle global environmental crime and dismantle trafficking networks, an effort that is increasingly focused on protecting our oceans. So, Olivia, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Lucy. It's a delight to be here.
Great. Well, so let's get down to business, shall we? So you've had an extraordinary career across international justice and diplomacy and now lead the charge against wildlife trafficking. So what first drew you to this field and how did that path eventually lead you to this?
Well, thank you for the question. And I think it's a great way to set the stage also for what we do at the Wildlife Justice Commission and our mission of stopping organized crime from driving species to extinction. My career has always been rooted in justice and the need for accountability for the gravest crimes. So I came to The Hague in the Netherlands, which is the legal capital of the world. And I worked at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and the Iran-United States Claims Tribunal, and later at the International Criminal Court. And the focus there often was on the most serious crimes, particularly at the criminal tribunals, on genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. And it was really important work, and I was very, very lucky to be able to make a small contribution to it. But at a certain point, I began to wonder if there was a way that I could deliver more tangible impact on the ground and also really see the impact on a problem that I thought we could solve in our lifetime. I was, you know, getting into my 40s. I thought, okay, I'm not going to work forever. What can I do that can really solve a devastating problem? And that's when I began to think about wildlife crime, because the devastation is absolutely horrific. It causes on biodiversity and our species, obviously, but rule of law and security and all these other, you know, human health, all these other impacts. And yet the drivers are slightly less complicated than they are for these other forms of criminality. So it's really about organized crime driving species to extinction. They're eager to make a lot of money. There's low risk of them getting caught. So I thought, you know what? I can bring this approach of serious, professional investigation, prosecution, accountability to the issue of wildlife crime, and therefore help to save these species before they're gone, before it's too late.
And that approach, are they as organized as organized crime, or were you able to see, you know, more of a faster impact?
They are organized as in organized crime, because that's what it is. It's organized criminal groups and these really systemic networks across the supply chain. Yet, because they're really interested in profit, they are doing things that make it a little more easier for us to go after those top-level criminals than you have when the drivers are things like power and territory and culture and things like that. So we've really made tremendous inroads in taking down these criminal networks, ensuring that the top level criminals are arrested and successfully convicted, and that the whole system really falls apart. And that's what we want. We don't need to just catch one poacher or one fisherman or one person cutting down a protected piece of the rainforest. What we need is to disrupt and dismantle the system that allows them to get away with it. And we've been very successful at that at the Wildlife Justice Commission.
Okay, let's come in at, but was there one moment that you, did you see something, an injustice, environmental injustice, and think, or was it a slow realization that this needed to be a subject that needed to be tackled?
It was more of a slow realization for me. I almost couldn't believe that we were allowing this to happen when I started looking into it. I mean, I have children. I want them to grow up in a world full of biodiversity. And some of it is we're losing, and that's for various reasons, but that we are losing iconic species. We're losing the rhinos and the elephants and the pangolin and the sharks and the sea cucumbers and the orangutans because people are making a lot of money from that. It just shocked me. And when I discovered what was happening, and I thought there is no way that I in good conscience can allow this to happen without doing everything that I can, and with many other partners and other organizations and colleagues, but I wanted to use my resources and my skills to help stop organized crime from creating a world where we didn't have these species anymore.
So tell me, let me understand, how what does this environmental organized crime look like? Give me some examples.
Yeah, so organized wildlife crime and environmental crime more generally looks like you would think that organized crime looks, which is unusual. It's been addressed as a conservation issue, which it is. We need to be protecting the marine ecosystems and we need to be protecting the terrestrial ecosystems, but it's also a law enforcement issue. So I'll give you one example. In one of our recent investigations, we tracked a trafficking kingpin who was operating across several Latin American countries. And his network was trafficking tons of shark fins to markets in Asia. And that represents the killing of hundreds and thousands of sharks. Hundreds and thousands of sharks. And this was being done in a very sophisticated way, similar to the way that criminal networks operate when they're trafficking in drugs and weapons and humans. So there were secret warehouses, there were logistic networks, there were financial flows, and really structured supply chains designed to move large amounts of illegal product across borders, including, you know, corrupt elements that allowed the facilitation of this. So it's really being driven by sophisticated criminal groups, and that's how we need to address it. And that's what we do, you know, on our website, wildlifejustice.org, we've got more examples of how we do this, but it's really about going after that supply chain.
So, I mean, shark fins though, I mean, I wouldn't have thought that if you were a sort of regular criminal, is it shark fins or dealing in drugs? I mean, how much money is involved in this? What is the stakes?
There is a tremendous amount of money being generated from wildlife crime. Wildlife crime alone is the fourth largest transnational organized crime. It generates, if you add the marine, terrestrial, and forest crimes, it's up to like $199 billion per year. And the cost to these local communities are $1 to $2 trillion a year. So it's very, very, very lucrative. And the chance of getting caught is low. So if you're a smart criminal, you know, why not do this? People don't seem to care. They're not devoting the resources that they're devoting to addressing organized drug criminality, for example. And yet the profits are very, very similar. So it just makes sense for these criminals to do it. And that's what we need to change. We need to make it really unattractive for them to do it by taking away the profits, making sure that the networks fall apart and that the kingpins, the top level criminals, end up convicted and behind bars.
So shark fins, I can think of, you know, illegal ivory trade. What other things are there? What other examples that you have dealt with?
One of my favorite cases concerns some turtles and tortoises. And I love the turtles and tortoises cases because nobody ever thinks of them, right? Everybody's thinking of the really iconic species, which are really important. You know, we've done some great work on pangolins, for example, absolutely shutting down the pangolin trafficking out of Nigeria together with the Nigerian Customs Service, and a phenomenal result on their behalf, and committing to these long-term investigative work, intelligence-led, really using data and analysis to figure out who the key individuals are. So we've done great work on the pangolins, but also on the sea cucumbers. And, you know, they're slightly less iconic. You know, they're a little funny looking. People aren't necessarily thinking about them being an important part of our ecosystem, but they are absolutely critical. They're sometimes known as the rumbas of the oceans because they keep the ecosystem clean, and similar to sharks that are called the doctors of the oceans because they take care and make sure, you know, the sick are weeded out, and they keep the ecosystem healthy. So whether it's the pangolin or the sharks, which have been around for longer than the dinosaurs have, or the elephants, or the turtles and tortoises, each species has an important role in maintaining our ecosystem and our biodiversity, and make sure it's healthy and it's able to do things like absorb carbon and contribute to a healthy environment for all of us. So I'm pretty agnostic with regards to species.
But why sea cucumbers? And is that's not for making soup with? I can see shark fin soup, turtle soup, tortoises. I'm not sure why people would want tortoises and sea cucumbers. Why?
Well, there's a variety of different reasons why these species are in demand. So sometimes turtles and tortoises, for example, are often desired, along with orangutans and species like that, for the live pet trade, the exotic pet trade. So people want to have a certain kind of tortoise because it's very rare, and they want to have it as a pet, or an orangutan. And when the orangutans are being captured, the babies, they often have to kill two parents in order to capture it. So the devastation is just huge. Sea cucumbers, that's more on a sort of traditional medicine in Asia, that it's used for that. And sharks, indeed, for shark fin soup. Rhino horn, very often for status symbols. So for bracelets or bowls to show somebody's wealth. So there are a variety of different reasons why these species are being sought after and decimated.
Is it mainly Asia, or that is a consumer of these trafficked goods, or is it throughout the world?
This is a global problem, and that's one of the things that I think is so important for us to keep in mind. So we have marine species in Latin America being decimated and being sent to Asia. You also have in the Middle East, there's demand for certain species. So in the Americas as well, it is a global issue, both supply, transit, and demand.
Fascinating. Fascinating. And no idea poor sea cucumbers are being targeted.
And seahorses also. Seahorses are these tiny little seahorses. And can you imagine how many they have to kill to make up a ton of them? So it's really devastating them. And the problem is they don't grow back easily, right? They have limited ability to refurbish their population. So when they're gone forever. That's terrifying.
I mean, people who are harvesting, these kingpins, there is a network and it goes down to the fishers, does it? Or how is this happening?
The networks work the kingpin is at top, but it depends. Sometimes it's very hierarchical. We did a great report on some work that the Chinese authorities had done in breaking down a network that had been trafficking in ivory from Africa to Asia, and it was really hierarchical with family members. And sometimes it's less hierarchical and more disparate in order to minimize risks, similar that you see in other forms of organized crime. But you basically have somebody leading the network, you have his or her deputy, you have brokers that are then dealing with the people that are collecting the product. For example, in Nigeria, in some of the cases we've done there with the pangolin and the ivory, there is the kingpins that are coming from Asia. There's local high-level traffickers, and then there's the brokers that are making sure that they've got enough pangolin. And then you have the people that are actually organizing the poachers to go out there and get them. And then you have the poacher. So you're not going to solve this problem by going after the fisherman or the poacher. They're easily replaceable. The way you're going to change this dynamic is by going after those top level people, and also the finance people. Who's making the money from it? Who's putting the money up? How are the logistics being done? Who's paying for the warehouses? Who's getting it from their source country? And whether that's in Latin America or in Asia or in Africa or in the Americas, who's getting it to the demand country? So if you can take out those different elements of the supply chain, you're going to disrupt the entire network and therefore have it fall apart, and it's going to prevent future crimes. And that's the goal, really, is to prevent these criminals from destroying our biodiversity.
But it's a tangled web, isn't it? And of course, corruption has a big part to play. So tell me about that. I bet that's something that, you know, keeps you up at night.
Absolutely. Corruption is the one thing that really gives criminals the advantage. Mm. It's the one thing that allows them to bypass the systems that we, as an international community and as people, citizens of the world, have put in place. So it basically allows them to manipulate the protections that are in place. So I'll give you an example related to shark fins. And that earlier case that I mentioned about the kingpin working across three different countries and how, to ship it into Asia. One of the ways that corruption played a role in that was there was a government official that was instrumental to facilitating these crimes. And this person issued fraudulent permits. So we have this regulatory system. There's a convention on the trade in endangered species, and it creates all kind of rules about when you can trade in a species that's really under threat. And in order to be able to do that, you have to get a permit. And if you have somebody within a government that can issue fraudulent permits, that can fake it, then you're allowing these protected species to be traded when they shouldn't be. And it also allows for sometimes when there's bycatch, it's allowed for bycatch, but they say that, they've got tons caught for bycatch, and that's very unlikely. So this corruption makes it possible to bypass the regulatory system. And it also plays a role in the transportation. So in the logistics system, we did a report on this as well, how corruption is really located within these transit hubs. So you need your guy at the airport or seaport to make sure that your package gets through. So that plays another important role.
So how do you deal with that? I mean, if it's that high level and that intrinsic into the network, how do you infiltrate it and stop it?
We address wildlife crime and environmental crime like we address other forms of organized crime. And that's the unique element that the Wildlife Justice Commission brings, is we really treat it like organized crime, and we know how to address organized crime. So colleagues and I have a long history of justice work, whether that's in the prosecution divisions or with judges or investigating, transnational crime. And we do what we've always done. So you infiltrate the networks, you conduct surveillance, you do intelligence analysis. And I think that is probably the biggest element that we add that we try and share with our local partners on the ground is the biggest game changer. So we use data. We look at, all kinds of databases. We do our own investigative work really on the ground with local partners and able to figure out who are the key individuals, where are their vulnerabilities, how can we get into that network so that we can then work to make sure that we're collecting evidence, really compelling evidence, working with the local prosecutors to bring these really strong cases, and having the top level criminals arrested and seize their assets and their profits so that they're just not worth it. And we now have 100% conviction rate for all of our cases that have gone before the courts. So we're really proud of that.
Amazing, amazing. And you talked about, just touch back with the local partners. You work with other organizations, don't you? A wider network.
Absolutely. We work with a variety of different partners. We are really good at what we do, but we're only part of the puzzle. And granted, a part of the puzzle that's been missing for a long time, that focus on conservation, on law enforcement, and realizing that this is not just a conservation element. But we bring our approach to a broader ecosystem of actors. So on the one hand, we work very, very closely with local enforcement agencies, and whether that's the organized crime police, for example, in Mozambique, or it's the Department of the Environment in Thailand, different partners on the law enforcement side. We also work with a lot of other conservation organizations, particularly to share our findings, to say, hey, we're seeing, for example, that rhino horn is really being trafficked for a demand in accessories and status symbols and less for medicinal. So it's important that you focus your work to reduce demand on these issues. And then also just partnering together on policy issues to raise awareness of these issues and to get more political will to address it. This is not a problem that has to happen. We can solve this. We just have to be committed to doing it.
And just tell me, how sophisticated are these criminals becoming? I mean, is it dark web? Is it, I mean, I'm sure it probably is.
These criminal networks are very sophisticated and becoming increasingly so. As governments, with our support, get more effective at addressing them, they have to step up their game. And that's good in a way because they're, you know, the sort of ones that are, we're thinking, maybe I shouldn't do it, it's too risky, they're getting out of it. So less individuals are participating, less networked. And we've actually seen that. We've seen criminal networks being dismantled. We've seen individuals say, literally, I'm not going to do this anymore. The risk is too huge. But they do use complex systems, the ones that are continuing to be active. They work across multiple countries. Sometimes they do things like business people, like they'll invest in a shipment of ivory or rhino horn or a shark fin so that they minimize their risk. They rely on legal loopholes. They use advanced financial systems, including crypto. So it's getting more and more sophisticated, which means we and our colleagues, our partners in the field and these local authorities need to be using smarter approaches. We need to be using a combination of investigative and analytical tools. So mapping the networks, you know, making sure we figure out who the key individuals are from a variety of different sources of data. And that analysis of the data is absolutely critical. And it makes you much more effective. Also, because if you add an extra ranger, you're not necessarily going to be making that, you know, it's a big difference. But if you add one intelligence analyst, their impact can be broader. So it's a way of being more effective and using that kind of sophisticated, intelligence-driven approach and reviewing also, you know, the financial data and the shipping patterns. All of that is part of addressing it.
It's a huge job. I mean, how many cases have you got going at one time?
We have lots and lots and lots of cases. And what's so interesting is they often, at the top level, will overlap, or there'll be links, or we'll be working on one case, you know, in a part of the world where we think is fairly self-contained. We've mapped out the network. We know where their logistics are. We know who their key people are. And then suddenly we'll see that they're interacting with a completely different network in another part of the world. So it's very integrated. But the more cases we do and the more data we have, the better we know what's going on globally and the more effect we can have. And that's really the only limitation to our work, is having the resources that we need to continue to build out these approaches around the world to make sure that we're addressing all of the key criminals and networks.
Fascinating. And across everything you're seeing, all of the, you know, dastardly deeds that are happening, I mean, which trafficked marine products or species concern you most right now, and why?
What concerns me most is the scale of the problem. That is really what I'm concerned the most. I mean, we are losing 100 million sharks per year. That's terrifying. And a big reason for that is the demand for shark fin soup and other niche products for shark fins. That is terrifying. And sharks play such an important role. So that is really where, when I'm, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, that's what I'm thinking about. What can we do to help save the sharks that are then going to keep our oceans healthy and make sure that we have, you know, the oceans being a good carbon sink and all the cascading effects? So that's really the thing that keeps me up at night.
That's the one species that you think the biggest problem right now.
I think so. I mean, sharks are also often trafficked together with the sea cucumbers and the seahorses. But I think given the role that sharks play in our ecosystem, it's an issue we need to address. And we know how to address it, which is the good news.
Great.
Sharks are so important to keeping biodiversity healthy and our oceans healthy. And that's why we really are focusing on the impact of the shark fin trade. And we did a phenomenal investigation together with local partners where we infiltrated this network of shark fin trafficker. We mapped the structure. We identified the key actors, including the corrupt official that I mentioned, and built a comprehensive intelligence picture. And by doing this long-term investigation with these local authorities, we have been responsible for two of the largest global seizures of shark fin ever. So one after the other, the largest ever reported. And, you know, we're one organization and we managed to contribute to 90% of all shark fin seizures in the past 18 months. And that is, you know, we are just getting started. We have so much more to do. So I think that makes me convinced that the sharks are really important, but we know how to address it.
You're doing a worthwhile job. Tell me any more success stories that you guys have had that you're proud of.
One success story that I'm proud of is the work with the Nigerian Customs Service to stop the devastation of pangolins and the trafficking of pangolins. Pangolins are these, you know, scaly little anteaters, and their only defense mechanism is to roll into a ball. And that might work for an animal trying to bite it, but it does not work for its greatest predator, which is man. So we just pick it up, and it's just horrific. And they don't populate well under captivity, and we were really at risk of losing them. If the trafficking had continued to the level it was in 2019, they would be extinct today.
What are they being used for?
They're used for traditional Chinese medicine, the scales for the most part, and then the bodies are used for meat. But it's really the scales that are driving the trafficking. And we were almost losing them. And we worked together with the Nigerians. Nigeria was the center of pangolin trafficking. So from all in neighboring countries, they would poach the pangolins, bring them to Nigeria, and from there they would be sent to Asia. I think Nigeria was responsible for about 50% of all seizures of pangolin scale. So they had some link to Nigeria. And we worked with the Nigerian Customs Service to change their approach, to not just go from, you know, seizing, from getting the person with the bag of pangolins, but to try and figure out who the kingpins are and go through the whole network and really invest time to doing that. And they did a tremendous job. And there hasn't been a major shipment of pangolin scales seized that have a link to Nigeria in over 4 years.
Amazing.
Top-level criminals arrested and prosecuted and convicted. Lots of information so we know what's happening. And you really see that the model works. And we can do this for any species, really. And that's the beauty. If you follow the network rather than the species, you can stop the trafficking of sea cucumbers and seahorses and sharks or ivory or, you know, elephants and rhinos and protected rosewood and all over the world.
Coming back to tortoises, because it's worrying, I didn't know, is that a problem that Europeans love tortoises and they're using them for pets, or what's the problem there?
The demand for the tortoises is often in other parts of the world. The Europeans are really into, like, snakes and lizards and scaly little things. And I think the largest demand country is in Europe for these types of animals. So it really is, you know, it takes all kinds. Every country seems to have its own desire for protected species, and we need to be making sure that we're not allowing this desire to drive these species to extinction.
100%, yes, agree. Okay, well, that's really, really interesting, and I think we've got through a lot today, and obviously at Ocean Talks you'll be telling us more. But what one action can listeners take today from this? From listening to this?
Well, if I could give more than one action.
Of course you can, yes.
I think there are a few things that we can all do, that listeners can do. The first is to be aware, and I'm hoping that this podcast is a start of an awareness to understand that this is a serious problem. Organized crime is driving our species and our ecosystems out of balance. And so that's one. The second is to support frontline organizations and working on these issues and addressing the cartels front on that are driving this. So if I had to choose one, I would say that's probably the thing that I think can make the biggest impact, is to support the frontline organizations such as Wildlife Justice Commission. And we have information on our website, wildlifejustice.org. The third thing I would say, the yachting community and people in general could promote responsible practices. So refuse to engage in activities that involve the exploitation of wildlife. And in fact, we're just going to put out a sort of easy reference guide, and others have done this as well, about the live pet trade, the turtles and tortoises, not engaging with people on social media that have orangutans dressed up and things like that. So really promoting responsible practices also in your in the work on the water. And then the fourth and final thing I would say is to support stronger protections. So we really need to be getting the political will to address these issues, to really get governments to focus on it, because we need to be treating it like the organized crime that it is. So we need the elected representatives to take the marine crime in particular, but all kinds of environmental crime and wildlife crime seriously, and to devote the resources necessary to addressing it. So those four things would be what I would hope that that the listeners and the community as a whole could contribute.
And also, if I take my son into a pet shop, just making sure that it, you know, if we were going to buy a snake, which we wouldn't be, but, you know, making sure that they're not on the endangered species, because it might be one snake, but actually it could be a crate load of snakes that have wiped out species somewhere in the world.
Exactly. Everybody has a role to play, every single person. And that's a great example of recognizing that we are all part of this problem, but we're also part of the solution. So we can take ownership of that. And this is not an unsolvable problem. There's an urgency to it. If we lose these species, they will be gone forever. So we need to act, but the good news is we know what we need to do, and we can do it. We just need the resources to be able to really scale it.
Olivia, so interesting. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I look forward to seeing you at Ocean Talks.
Thank you. Looking forward to it too. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Olivia, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us and for the vital work you're doing. If you'd like to hear more, you can meet Olivia in person at Ocean Talks 2026 on the 11th of June. Now in its ninth year, this annual event brings together the superyacht industry and leading voices in marine conservation for meaningful conversations, inspiring talks, and valuable networking opportunities. Held in partnership with the Ocean Family Foundation, this year's event introduces a new format designed to drive greater impact and foster stronger connections. Visit boatinternational.com to apply for tickets. And that's all we have for this week's episode of Boat Briefing, a production of Boat International Media, sponsored by Amico & Co. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.